I'd like to welcome you all to the Writers Center tonight for the first in our fall Digger series. The Digger series was started in the spring as a way of uncovering some of Gloucester's histories that we tend to sweep under the rug or at least don't address. So I'm very excited tonight to have you here and to have Grace here. I want to tell you about some of the other things going on at the Writers Center this fall. On Wednesday, October 29th, we have Jennifer Bartlett, who is doing a biography of Larry Einar. We have Thursday, October 30th, there's a benefit performance of Brothers of the Brush at the Gloucester Stage Company. On Saturday, November 1st, we have a poetry salon with Leanne Brown and Joseph Massey. Monday, November 3rd, an open mic. Thursday, November 6th, is the second of the Digger series, and I'm excited about this one too. We have Gregor Gibson and John Rosenthal talking about gun violence, and that will be over at the Rocky Neck Cultural Center. On Wednesday, November 12th, we have Kent Bowker. Wednesday, November 19th, Otto Lasky. December 1st, another open mic. And December 4th, we have Fish Tales coming up. There's also not listed on here, there's a reading on November 13th, I think it is, the Thursday, at Rocky Neck Cultural Center in collaboration with the Massachusetts Cultural Council. And that should be good because the professor, David Daniel, whom I met my husband in his class, will be reading that night. So that's exciting for me. In September of 1692, nine Gloucester women were accused of witchcraft. Esther Elwell, Margaret Prince, Elizabeth Dicer, Joan Penny, Phoebe Day, Mary Rowe, Rachel Vinson, Abigail Rowe, and Rebecca Dyke. That same year, Gloucester resident Ebenezer Babson asked some of the afflicted Salem village girls to visit his mother, who was complaining of spectral visions of Indians and French soldiers. Much of the documentary evidence has been lost, but we have Grace. Grace is a Gloucester native, and she wrote her thesis, When Vengeance Wrote the Law, about the Cape Ann women who were accused of witchcraft in the 1690s, and why they were accused. I am looking forward to hearing you talk tonight. Everybody, Grace Schraft.
Oh, happy Halloween. And I think that's one of the things I can't bear about Salem is the circus carnival atmosphere that happens in Salem, the city of Salem, this time of year. It sort of makes fun of the horrors and the sadness that happened back in the 1690s in Salem Village, but that crept into the town of Salem and to Gloucester. Hi, Joyce. I found my thesis yesterday, so please be nice to me. one of the premises of this book was to attempt to show that old grudges, some dating back to the 1650s, among the first families here, was what started maybe 50 years ago revenge upon if these people were dead, their children and their grandchildren. And they formed the basis of many of the witchcraft accusations that happened on Cape Ann. Babson, in his history, neglected to give the maiden names of nearly half of the hapless accused women, but I did my utmost to trace their genealogies through other records. And I don't know if it's just terribly obvious to everybody that misogyny is what created most of this. And even though witchcraft accusations and hangings and burnings had stopped pretty much even in England in the 1650s, the fact that the Puritans came over in 1623 with their fire and brimstone attitudes, their hatred of women and the fear of what was going around them in the New World and their poverty made this come back to life. And even though the backers of the Dorchester Company came over for business reasons and were not all Puritans. But what that did was, different from the other towns in Essex County, there were people who were not Puritans, who were Episcopalian or didn't believe in anything. And the first few, there were 73 families who came originally here. And, well, I'll just have to read some of this stuff. Even the backers of the Dorchester Company, there was a minister, Reverend John White, a Puritan, but mostly the Dorchester Company was based on capitalism. And there were grudges that came over even from the old days. And most of the Indians had been knocked off on Cape Ann, but they were still alive and well in the hinterlands north and west of us. And there was a lot of fear of those Indians. And much like Plymouth to the south and Salem, and other 17th century Essex County towns that were originally settled and governed by the Puritan establishment were of like-minded people who were into communalism and farming and following some medieval historic ways of life in the old world. The purpose of the Cape Ann Venture was clearly more mercantile than missionary, and Gloucester's beginnings had colonists with no faith at all, including, I'm quoting, a drunken beast, men of ill carriage, and even worse, adherents of the established Anglican Church. Puritanism came to be called, Congregationalism, won out in Gloucester as the church state, as it did earlier throughout the whole Massachusetts Bay Colony. But our first half century is marked by old country geographic factions among West country settlers who took the new Puritan ethos lightly, and they were not looked upon as civilized people. Even though we had dense primeval forests on Cape Ann, as we know, it was not fit really for much gardening or farming. And so from the beginning, the risk-taking, individualistic, seafaring types are what settled this town. And the others located to towns to the north and west where ground was flatter and more fertile and the church much more powerful. Gloucester was haven to the likes of a shipwrecked adventurer named Fells, who with his paramour fled to Gloucester from Plymouth in the late 1620s to escape just punishment at the hands of the Puritans, said Babson. And there are many other like-minded fishing entrepreneurs whose beliefs and action refused to adhere to the fundamentalist promises of their outlying neighbors. And while people of Salem and Plymouth found spiritual succor in the pronouncements of their Puritan elders and clergy, religious strife harassed Gloucester's town people for the first 40 years of our existence. One after another, men of the cloth would take the pulpit and be judged unfit to serve, leaving gaps of time when the flock had no shepherd and the people turned into a disorderly subculture. One of the settlement's first clerics was the Episcopalian Reverend Lyford, about whom Babson, sounding as if he were still under the sway of his puritanical ancestors, wrote in 1860 that soon after Lyford's arrival, he engaged in a course of conduct that resulted in his expulsion from the colony. Historical evidence of the highest authority, recently published, said Babson, leaves no room to doubt that he was a very bad man. A recital of his guilty deeds would be an unfit narrative for these pages, said Babson. But the truth was that it was nothing more than his enthusiasm for the Church of England that got him in trouble. And Babson's evidence, although recently published in 1859, was written in the 1700s by a Congregationalist who spoke much more kindly of Lyford than Babson did and said, Nothing but Lyford's unscrupulous zeal for episcopacy was alleged against his conduct while in this country, and we have reason to believe that his followers were attached to him. He appears to have been a person of agreeable manners and address, and a preacher of moderate, if not brilliant, abilities, and both at Cape Ann and Namkeag undoubtedly continued his ministrations with acceptance, conducting a church in accordance with the usages and requirements of the Episcopal Church. It was in 1642 that there were finally enough people here to incorporate into the town of Gloucester. And that's the same year that the first parish church came into being, headed by the Reverend Richard Blimmen, who came from Monmouthshire, England. And he landed first at Plymouth, but when dissension arose about him and his parish there, he went by the worst, said Babson, and was impelled to leave. Blimmen was not such a great spiritual leader, but he was a good businessman, and he's the one who was the Blimmen Brit. He's the one who cut the cut and made it so that boats wouldn't have to go all the way around the Cape to go out fishing. And but 2 years after he arrived, none of these guys lasted very long, maybe 5 years at most. And William Stevens, who was the deputy of the general court, had private differences between Blimmen and the between himself and the church headed by Blimmen. And the church elders chose a Mr. Brown to replace him. But the general court still had lots of power, even though the church may have been more powerful. And the court sent Brown, sent Brown away and brought Stevens back in. And so that made Stevens carry a grudge. And Blimmen lost a round with Stevens, who had a lawsuit against him. This is the sort of stuff that started. It wasn't long before Blimmen's was openly challenged for his pastoral abilities, and some stopped going to church altogether. And in 1649, Blimmen was called to court by Anthony Day of Riverdale, of Riverdale Mills, for having torn up a writ that Day had taken out against William Vincent, or Vincent. These names are spelled differently all the time, Vincent's Cove, Vincent Street. And Blimmen's defense was he did it, he tore up that writ, not out of contempt of authority, but only to stop the proceeding that the matter might be privately healed. And Blimmen was let off for doing that, but said that from now on he could not do such rash actions herewith. And so by 1651, Blimmen and some of his followers left the inhospitable, ungodly people of Cape Ann and resettled in Connecticut. After he left, a small group of seafarers undertook to develop the fishery that he had earlier undertaken to stimulate. And according to historian Christine Hireman, and by the way, I have copies of the bibliography here, according to her, who wrote about Marblehead and Gloucester and Salem and the differences between those people. The fisherman John Jackson was represented of all of them all, and within the space of 2 years, Jackson was presented to the county court for debt, for obscene language — this is a typical fisherman — and for the attempted rape of his servant maid. Perhaps because neighbors suspected his wife of witchcraft, he sued two of them for slander. Throughout the 50s and early 60s, other shoremen and fishermen figured conspicuously in civil cases of debt and defamation, and in criminal cases of assault, drunkenness, and husbands living apart from their wives, according to Hireman. When nobody wanted to come forth to replace Blimmen, William Perkins of Weymouth, who was not a minister but a teaching elder, was induced to resettle in Gloucester to become the spiritual guide of a little band of worshippers there living, according to Babson. But Perkins could endure no more than 5 years of ill treatment at the hands of this little band, his congregation, and he pulled up stakes to resettle in Topsfield. And after unloading his Gloucester land and ministry into the hands of Thomas Millet, it was said of Perkins by a disgruntled worshiper, quote, that his sermons were so dead he was fitter to be a lady's chamberman than to be in a pulpit. And nobody could get away with talking like this in Plymouth or Salem. Perkins ended up suing and winning a defamation suit in 1653 after one of his detractors accused his wife and three other women of the church and his defenders of witchcraft. And those three women, all friends of Perkins, also won slander suits against the accuser, and their names were Agnes Evans, Grace Dutch, who was wife of Osmond Dutch, and Sarah Vincent, wife of William Vincent, the same man that Blimmin had unsuccessfully tried to heal of debt by ripping up the complaint against him. Thank God for Agnes Evans' family. They moved out of town, and went to Topsfield. But clannish grudges have long memories, and Sarah Vincent and her daughter 30 years later, Vincent's second wife, Rachel, and Grace Dutch, who was the daughter of Esther Elwell, were convicted of witchcraft. Before 1663, the arrival of Reverend John Emerson, who was a Congregationalist, before he got here, it was said that Gloucester had gone to hell in a bucket. Before his pastorate, factionalism and a lack of any kind of religious leadership resulted in anarchy that stood in the way of progress, of any sort of progress, and inducing many families to migrate elsewhere. Right? And these were the lucky people. Essex court records indicate that between 1650 and 1669, five citizens were charged with assault or threats of assault, 16 with slander, 13 with reviling the minister of the church or the church, 3 with theft, 2 with living apart from their wives, 2 with swearing, 2 with absence from worship, 1 with drunkenness, and 1 with lewdness and attempted rape. According to Babson's figures, of the 73 families who first settled in Gloucester before 1650, 51 of them left town. During the 1650s, they left town in the midst of citizen unrest, and only 25 families arrived. But of the ones who stayed, you will see that they are the ones who, their descendants were the accused. But thank God that Emerson came in the late 50s, and his arrival made stabilization of the population. By the 1660s, 12 new families arrived in Gloucester, while only 9 left. In the 1670s, 14 families and 3 left. In the 1680s, 11 families arrived and only 1 left town. Among the few families persevering from the beginning, there wasn't enough communal sentiment or moral determination, manpower or money to lead Gloucester into being a thriving community that could sustain better than subsistence farming, commercial fishing, or boat building. In 1656, John Rowe, having lent his support first to Mr. Blimmin, then to Perkins, and finally to Millet, he was just trying to have peace in the community. He expressed exasperation towards his townsmen in a speech so becoming a Puritan that he was fined for it. And history shows that though Goodman Rowe paid his fine, he was not forgiven. And had his wife possessed psychic abilities attributed to witches, she would have gladly allowed her husband to give the devil the farm and with their sons, John and Hugh, leave Gloucester forever. It turned out that Rowe's daughter-in-law, Mary Rowe, and her granddaughter, Abigail Rowe, were both condemned as witches in 1692. And despite being repressive, Puritanism in the form of the Reverend Emerson brought some relief from Gloucester's moral and fiscal woes. Emerson was a a good guy. He was the son of a prosperous Ipswich farmer, son-in-law. He went to Harvard, graduated in 1656. He was the son-in-law of the former Bay deputy governor, and he commenced his labors in Gloucester in 1661. And among those attending his ordination was the Reverend John Higginson of Salem, a very moderate Puritan who later played a big dissenting role in the infamous witch trials of Salem Village. And, you know, Salem Village was what's not part of Danvers now. It wasn't part of the town of Salem. It was an outback, you know, an outlying. Okay, so Millet, he wasn't even... They owed him back pay, but they just kicked him out and wouldn't pay him back. But Emerson's salary was agreed to in advance, fixed at £60 a year, as long as he should continue in the ministry. And he was to receive it in Indian corn, peas, barley, fish, mackerel, beef, or pork. But 1679, his pay had increased by another £8 a year. And after that, he was granted periodic raises, including £80 for building a house, 30 acres of land grant at his homestead, another 30 acres near the burying ground, and other smaller lots. He did very well. He is the guy who built a new meeting house with a bell and two galleries, and the population of the congregation tripled. An example of his fatherly concern for the interests of Cape Ann is preserved in one of his only two surviving letters. This one to Commander Wait Still. Can you imagine that was this guy? Wait Still Winthrop, head of the militia, who in 1690 pressed into service too many of Gloucester's young men. And this is what he said. May it please you to cast an aspect upon these few lines to acquaint your honor with the sad and deplorable condition of our town, and also humbly to crave your help and succor in our condition. Sir, the case we have to spread before you is that whereas there is 47 of our soldiers under press, having been conscripted, the case so stands with us that if they be not released, I must tell you, and it is nothing but truth that I tell you, we must all be forced to leave this town, for we are not able to stay any longer after they are gone, but must of necessity be made prey to the enemy. We shall not have men left to keep us a watch, nor in any wise, much less to withstand the enemy, which we are in every day and night in expectation to break in upon us, by reason that we are a front town upon the sea, and so good a harbor for shipping as I believe there is not a better nor a bolder in all New England. Those under press are above half of those that train, and besides, there will be nothing near enough left to get in hay and harvest, so that we must of necessity be forced to kill our cattle and are in great danger of being famished. Therefore, my request to yourself is that you will be pleased to release all these men that are under this last press, there being already listed 15 volunteers for Canada besides 7 that are pressed to the Indian Wars. Therefore, if you please not to relieve us in releasing of these men, we must of necessity, as above said, and the inhabitants do resolve upon it, to leave the town rather than live in continual hazard and fear of our lives, and to be exposed to all other calamities. So having given you a true account of the case that stands with us, I leave it to further consideration and discretion, hoping you'll want to grant my request in giving your assistance, and with my service to your most humbly take leave and remain, sir, your affectionate kinsman and servant. Emerson died in 1770. He was still a minister. He was beloved by his flock, and he served more than 40 years in the gospel of God's dear son, said Babson. But even Emerson couldn't heal the half-century-old and still festering wounds that were inflicted upon and by certain families of his parish. And the unresolved differences arose during the days of his four predecessors. Even his handling of the Quaker invasion in Gloucester was level-headed and diplomatic compared to what was going on in Boston and Cambridge. During his tenure, the Society of Friends tried to little avail to establish itself in Gloucester. There would be no separation of church and state, of course, until nearly a century after Emerson's death. Reason rather than repression was the hallmark of Emerson, and in other parts of the colony, Quakers were denounced and persecuted as heretics. And when they first appeared in Boston in 1656, their punishment for meeting together was to lose an ear. For a second offense, they took their other ear. The Quakers who dared remain in Boston were next subject to a hot iron through the tongue. In the early 1660s, three earless Quakers, among them Elizabeth Kendall of Cambridge, went to the gallows, Kendall Square. Compared to the atrocities committed everywhere then, Gloucester under Emerson tolerated dissent by Quakers, and even when a local member of the Society of Friends had the audacity to invite him to a Quaker meeting, he said he merely labored to convince him of the evil of it and the breach of the law of this commonwealth, according to Essex court records. But if you want the bibliography, I have it. The wife of Morris Soames, one of Gloucester's earliest settlers, was Elizabeth Kendall Jr. of Cambridge, and she took her martyred mother's name and religion, and her children, including John and Abigail Soames, joined the Society of Friends, and the only molestation inflicted on them and other Gloucester Quakers under Emerson's tutelage was an occasional citation for absenteeism at Orthodox services. It was only when they moved off the Cape that John and Abigail came to suffer at the hands of Puritans less tolerant than Emerson. And after he moved to Boston, John Soames was publicly whipped twice in 1677 for attending Quaker meetings. And her fate, his wife's fate, was sealed when she left Gloucester and moved to Salem. Not a, she wished she hadn't, I'm sure. In 1650, the witchcraft persecution in Europe had slowed down to nothing, even in England, one of the continent's last strongholds. And the reason why witch hunts manifested themselves to such an extreme here in New England, even a half a century later, are the subject of many theories, and they deserve to be explored. And an interesting rationale for the European epidemic is found in Keith Thomas's Religion and the Decline of Magic. And the great bulk of these accusations in Europe reflected unresolved conflict between the neighborly conduct of the old village community and that conflict with the increasing individualistic forms of behavior that accompanied economic changes of the 16th and 17th centuries, which was the era that transformed Europe's communal peasant society, which was still medieval in structure and values, into the modern world of commercial capitalism. Well, Puritanism kept that communal out of necessity in the New World, and that was sort of part of their structure of religion. So a good candidate for witchcraft accusation in the old country was a poorer person, usually a woman who relied on the tradition of communal responsibility by asking for a favor, alms, maybe food or lodging from somebody who was richer. And in this model, the affluent, who failed to conform to tradition by denying the beggar's request, felt guilt over his moral lapse, and then would claim that it was the beggar who was morally culpable. And he'd strengthen his claim by saying that when he denied her, the beggar retaliated angrily, maybe uttered a curse, and the curse came to pass. Thus witchcraft accusations made it possible for the uncharitable to divert attention from their sin by focusing on the sin of witchcraft. And we saw that in the late 90s and into the 2000s in places like North Carolina, I think it was, or South Carolina, where the traditional wife and mother stayed home with her kids and then dared take a job or have other outside interests and put the kids in daycare. And suddenly, their guilt seemed to have made the daycare personnel vulnerable to sexually molesting these kids. And there were all bunches of persecutions in the South about that that turned out to be not based at all in reality. And I think it was that same sort of feeling, right, South Carolinian, that made that all come to pass. New England's Puritan system of government kept its communal mode of behavior alive way beyond 1650, and accusations of witchcraft made it possible to keep up the old medieval order of values and stave off the threat of the emerging era of competition and individualism. If one believed, as did our very reverend and learned Cotton Mather preach, that an all-powerful Satan was waging war with God for the bodies and souls of sinners, and that everyone, especially daughters of Eve, were sinners, then the notion of witchcraft, he used that word, that expression, daughters of Eve, then the notion of witchcraft was strengthened and preserved, and Puritans were suspicious of science and said that storms and blighted crops, smallpox, and all the misfortunes were the devil's doings, and there were plenty of misfortunes here. And compounding the real dangers plaguing the faithful of Essex County were the Quaker invasion, Anglicans, Catholics, French, Indians, all of whom, he said, were aligned with Satan. And for years, Mather, who was the Puritan Moses of Massachusetts Bay, boomed out to all who'd listen, frightening messages of, quote, a power of devils in our New England air that are seeking to hurt us. Methinks, he raved, I hear the Lord from heaven saying over us, oh, that my people had hearkened unto me, then I should soon have subdued the devils as well as the other enemies. And the common thread running through all the recorded witch persecutions of Europe and the New World, of course, is misogyny. And all women would have to live in its shadow. And more diabolical forecasts for New England, Mather, master of misogyny, instilled in both sexes his fear and loathing of the feminine. Quote, that all New England should have these abominations. Alas, what humiliations are we all hereby obliged unto. Oh, 'tis a defiled land. Let us be humbled for these defiling abominations, lest we be driven out of our land. What reproaches will be cast upon us among the daughters of the Philistines? His writings are peppered with such expressions as ignorant and scandalous old woman, mouthpieces for the father of lies, insolent and abusive women. And why the Puritans just accepted women as Satan's evildoers is traced back to Europe and the Dominican German priests who wrote the Malleus Malefactorum in 1486, who said that women more than men are ministers of the devil. And they claim because Eve is their role model and subject to deeper affections and passions, harboring uncontrollable appetites as a result of being created intellectually and morally weaker than men. Women were more inclined to turn to Satan to fulfill their needs. And then this father of the Spanish Inquisition, Father Martin de Castaneda, said that women witches were more likely to be old rather than young, because once they're old and men pay no attention to them, the women have recourse to the devil to satisfy their appetites. He continued that the combination of age and poverty made a woman even more inclined to witchcraft, because men had even less interested in her. And the quote is, alone, without men to support them, they become dissatisfied and turn to the devil to provide their material needs. Like other vices, he added, poverty is often the source of many evils in persons who do not choose it voluntarily as nuns and priests, or do not endure it patiently. Okay, so 1691, you all know what happened in Salem. The Reverend Samuel Parris, who was the pastor of Salem Village Church, had living with him and his wife a daughter, a niece, maidservant. And the niece, these kids, they were girls, and they were wondering about their future, and with the help of Tituba, their slave from the West Indies, who told them what to do to find out what their future would be, broke an egg into a glass, and they were gathered at Samuel Parris's house. And Samuel Parris, the Reverend, was the most self-aggrandizing pastor, and even though these kids knew that the diversions were sinful, curiosity overcame them. And in answer what trade their sweetheart should be of, as soon as they asked that, they saw a specter in the likeness of a coffin. And something within them, maybe their guilt or whatever, surfaced, and the girls panicked and became afflicted with spasms of weeping. It soon gave way to more bizarre behavior, with bodies jerking and swaying, and from their mouths spewed spittle and utterances of meaningless babble. They confessed their clandestine doings to their elders, who, after consulting with a local physician, agreed that Tituba, the slave, through her occult teachings, afflicted the girls with the devil. And Tituba, who was always beaten by Paris, immediately confessed to the practice of witchcraft. And pretty soon, many more of the Salem girls, young women in Salem Village, were afflicted. And when they came upon certain other villagers, they would cry out upon them or identify them as witches. But it just so happened that most of the accused were opponents of Paris in civil and religious factionalism, abetted by his harsh and exasperating manner, families of his congregation and some of Salem. The afflicted girls were supported and encouraged in their accusation by Reverend Paris and those who were loyal to him. And it was a carnival atmosphere that began to prevail, with everybody, farmers and magistrates and the Puritan elite, regular people, flocked to witness what was going on with these girls. And in a foreshadowing of fear-mongering of Joseph McCarthy, the witch hunt, an Andover man named Willie Barker bragged that he could provide the names of 307 satanic operatives in Essex County alone. Charles Upman, who is a historian of Salem, wrote in 1867 that Paris seemed to have a love of excitement that was irrepressible and all but insane passion for getting up the scene. And it will be for charitable judgment to determine whether this trait of his nature may not be regarded as the cause of all the woes in which he involved others and became involved himself. Scores of arrests were made. The accused were strip searched, put in prison, and waited trial for months in overcrowded jails. In May 1692, the governor established a special court of oyer and terminer, which is a bastardized Latin for to hear and determine, the enormous backlog of the witchcraft cases. And within 13 months from the time that the girls first cried out, there were 200 people, 167 of the women, put in prison. 19 were hung. One of the men was taken into a field and pressed to death by stones, and 8 died in jail. Abigail Soames was the first native to be accused, having the bad luck to be living in Salem at the time. And she was the daughter of Morris and Isabel Kendall, the Quaker Soames. And they came from the Mill River section of town, my part of town. Abigail was taken from her bed where she'd been an invalid for a year, recuperating from smallpox. And even though she was housebound, she was accused by Mary Warren, who had never seen her, of being the instrumental means of the death of Southwick, upon which Soames, casting her eye on Warren, pitched her into a dreadful fit, and Soames' specter bit her so dreadfully that the like was never seen on any of the afflicted. Further, pins into her side, which, being plucked out, the blood ran out furiously. Warren further affirmed Soames told her that when she did go abroad at any time, it was always in the night. Abigail Soames was taken to Thomas Beadle's tavern in Salem, where she was relieved of her clothes and her body examined for what they called a witch's tip, some sort of mark, where they would the witches would nurse the devil, some kind of weird physical appendage. And the devil would be sucking on her tit. The devil would be in the form of a bird, a turtle, or some other small creature known as a familiar. And in Salem, as in Europe, there were particular types of women who were the most vulnerable to accusations. And Abigail Soames fit into these categories in many ways. She was single, she had been sick, she was still sick, she had no property, and she was beyond childbearing age for her time, so she was without value. Abigail was also away from the protection of her Gloucester family and living in Salem as the ward Sam Gaskell, one of Salem's leading Quakers, whose religion made him a heretic and an easy suspect for witchcraft. And Cotton Mather described how friends at their meetings looked to be taken with, quote, a strange quaking, which looked so like a diabolical possession. And of course, her smallpox disfigured her, made her ugly, and any one of the scars could have been a witch's tit. And with certain other aspects of a woman's appearance figuring into old world and New England Puritan notions of guilt, of all, quote, of all other women, lean, hollow-eyed, beetle-browed women, end of quote, were the most suspect. Without a trial, she was in prison that very May afternoon, and although she did escape death, she didn't see the light of day till the next year in January. Ann Dolliver was a Gloucester woman accused 2 weeks later. She was a Higginson, the daughter of the Reverend Higginson, who of Salem, the town of Salem, who was always against witchcraft purge. And she was apprehended at the Salem home of her dad, the Reverend John Higginson, who was the pastor of the Salem church. And the wording of her arrest warrant indicates the ease with which such charges could be brought. And it said, "We will apprehend and forthwith bring before us Ann Dolliver, the wife of William Dolliver of Gloucester, who stands charged with having committed sundry acts of witchcraft on the bodies of Mary Warren and Susanna Shelton to the hurt of their bodies. And if Mary Warren's testimony wasn't enough to convict her, another of the afflicted girls related overhearing a conversation that incriminated Mary beyond doubt and said, Elizabeth, the wife of Edmund Nicholson, will testify that coming to the house of Samuel Dolliver, Peter Pitford and the wife of Dolliver were in discourse before the door in the yard, and in their discourse she heard Peter Pitford say to, I marvel how that old witch knows everything that's done in my house. And Rebecca, the wife of Sam Dolliver, replied, oh, Peter, don't say so, for I believe she is no witch. So she came away and left Peter Pitford and the wife of Samuel Dolliver in discourse. And Ann Dolliver was an an unhappy one, and her husband was charged with idleness, neglect of his family, and he left the colony, and he left his wife behind, and the poor woman had to go to her father's house in Salem. And Higginson, by then, was in his late 70s, had relinquished most of his official duties to the next pastor. And always Higginson had spoke out against the witchcraft falsehood that Paris championed. And that was the reason that she was probably accused. And Charles Upman wrote that the accusers never struck at friends, but were sure to punish all who were suspected to disapprove of the witchcraft proceeding. But it was impossible to break down the influence or independence of Higginson. He feared not to bear testimony to personal worth and could not be brought to cooperate in violence or fall into the spirit of the persecution. The accusers, although wanting to punish and discredit Higginson for his lack of enthusiasm for the witch trials, they didn't dare attack him directly and instead persecuted Anne. and she was in prison without a trial until 1693. And she never regained her equilibrium after the witchcraft trials had ended. She was called a poor, deranged woman living after the death of her father in a state of non-compos mentis and alienation from all her friends, dependent on the town for maintenance. So, in Gloucester, in the summer of 1692, Ebenezer Babson's family, and Babson, of course, the ancestor of the historian, the family was startled to hear sounds of feet tramping outside their house near Cape Pond. And on a night when he arrived home unusually late, Babson saw two men run from the house and disappear into the cornfield. But not before he heard part of their conversation that said, "The man of the house has come now, else we might have taken the whole house." And all the Babsons left the house that night and hurried for the nearest garrison fort, with the intruders hot in pursuit. Several nights after, these interlopers were heard lurking around the garrison, and Babson spotted two strangers he took to be French. The next day, he and several men from the garrison took off after six unidentified men, caught up with two of them and aimed his gun, but it misfired, and he came upon three others, one wearing a white waistcoat, and this time he felled them all. But as soon as he reached their bodies, they got up and ran, firing at him as he went. One of his pursuers, all means of escape were cut off, approached Babson, who shot at him as he was getting over the fence. He saw him fall to the ground, but when Babson came to the spot where he fell, the man could not be found. Afterwards, several men were seen lurking around the garrison, and great discoursing in an unknown tongue was heard in a swamp near. After this, the men were seen, who were supposed to be French and Indians. Babson was fired upon his way to the harbor to carry the news, and finally, after enduring these disturbers of the peace of the town for 2 weeks, the people sent abroad for help, and the detachment of 60 militia came from Ipswich to protect Babson and his homestead and their neighbors, but none of the mysterious interlopers were ever seen again. Of course, that wouldn't be a surprise, because they were too ethereal to leave a footprint on the soft places. And in 1692, Babson was all the more skittish by what had happened, and he wanted to keep his name in the limelight, says I. And he complained that two old women, Margaret Prince, the widow of Thomas Prince, and Elizabeth Dicer, wife of the Boston seaman, had grievously hurt and tortured Eleanor Babson, the widow. And the widow Prince was further incriminated by the testimony of three Salem village girls and Ebenezer Babson's Eleanor of having committed certain detestable acts called witchcraft and sorceries. And all of these people are related to old feuds, except the Babson one, which seems to have been about wanting the surrounding land that was owned by the Rose and the Tars, which he did get, because their women descendants were accused and jailed and sent away. Some of these women were bailed out by their sons for a lot of money, for which they had to relinquish their lands in order to bail out these women. And that goes for Phoebe Day, who was Phoebe Wilde, and she got here late. She grew up in Topsfield, but she was related to the Vincents and the Princes and the Rose. And her Mary Rose's father-in-law, John, was the man who consigned Gloucester to the devil 40 years before in a tirade aimed at his fellow townsmen for their ill manners during the ministries of Blinman and his successors. What I should have done in this is have made family trees so that you could read them, because this gets really boring, doesn't it? Finally, the girls started crying out to everyone, including the governor. And after that, they decided to shut down the witch trials. And then for the next 30 years, nothing could be talked about. It was just a silence. It was an official silence, so that there were no records were kept after that about what happened and why. And that's what makes it more sort of difficult to find out and what happened.
But Grace, were you saying that they were accused in order to get land?
And the Babson one was, yeah. The Rose and the Tars and the people who surrounded Cape Pond, where Babson had his, you know, where the Babson Cooperage is, they were all accused. And I hope there's no Babson descendants here, but it seems to be what happened among with those people. And the names, you know, all these names are very familiar in streets and bridges and town, you know. And then the next, when people think about Gloucester and witchcraft, they think about more than these people, the women in Dogtown who were thought to be witches, who, whether or not they liked that, because maybe they did too, that's about the only power they had was to curse people. There was Tammy Younger and Peg Wesson. And who was the third one?
Easter or somebody.
Easter was...
Easter Carter.
No, but Easter was not...
She wasn't.
No, Easter was the he-she, right? The she-he?
Oh, I don't know.
Judy Rhine.
Yes, Judy Rhine.
But that was later.
No, yeah, that's all. They're all later, those people. Thomasine Younger and Peg Wesson and Judy Rhine all around the same time. And they, too, were old and poor and living in Dogtown with no visible means of support.
Now this court of Oye and Terman or whatever it is, that was actually in Salem itself, right?
Yes.
Can you actually
the court
go
was there
go to the
in the town in the city of Salem,
so
the town of Salem.
In your work, Grace, did you go and look?
I spent so much time at the Essex Historical Institute, I can't tell you.
So are there court records? You say that it was gone, and people didn't talk about it.
Well, they weren't allowed to talk about it, but they didn't take the records out, but it was not to be discussed. And lots of things. There was an official ban on talking about it.
But the records are there.
The records are there.
As to who said what,
yep.
When, and the
right.
Trial.
So it's really easy to figure out why this happened historically, and why the ones who were accused were accused.
Was it ever talked about?
What's that?
Was it ever talked about?
It's you know, probably when. The church was no longer the state, you know, when there finally became a separation thanks to the UUs. That was it. That's it.
Grace, were many of the women who were accused of being witches midwives as well?
Were they midwives? That's what the European purge was about, when herbalists and midwives and, you know, doctoring herbalists who were all women, wanted to, this male establishment wanted to take that over. And I think that's really, well, maybe not in the Spanish and the German, Dominican Inquisition,
about,
but yes. Well, you know, she probably had more, she just probably had, you know, she was richer and more powerful. Her family had land and money, however they got it. And and then she was, after the witch, you know, after the Salem witchcraft, probably, I think Isabel Babson might have been 50 years later. I'm not sure. Does anybody know?
What?
She was doing midwifery in the 1650s?
Grace, is that your phone, you think?
I think it is, yes, I should.
Just two questions.
The speaker forgets to turn off.
So, yeah.
You're in trouble.
So are there any questions? I'm sorry this was so disjointed and read out loud.
I have a question.
What?
When they were imprisoned for a year or two, it sounds like, where was that? Was that in Gloucester or was that in Salem?
There was a jail in Topsfield. And there was also in the town of Salem. I don't know where the Gloucester women were relegated.
Were any of the Gloucester women killed?
No, they weren't. They were let out of prison because when it got to be too obviously crazed out, you know, when the big shots in Boston, wives were accused, the governor's wife, and I think even Cotton Mather's wife was accused. They were let out. So they were later accused. You know, they weren't in the first round of the witchcraft accusations, except for the poor child who moved to Salem. And even she got out. Yeah, I think somebody. Well, no, that was a Salem woman who died in prison, who was pregnant and died in childbirth.
But nobody was like thrown in with rocks.
No, that was a proctor. I think his name was in Salem who had the and who said, "Put more rocks on me because it was such a painful thing."
So isn't there a theory about the storing of grain
or ergot? Yep, it's a theory.
Do you have thoughts about that?
I don't. No, I don't think that was it. I think it was just the hysteria. The girls got attention, and they were egged on by the Parises, and it just fit into what they wanted to do. And the Putnam, I know that the nurse, Rebecca Nurse, who was a very stalwart, perfectly religious woman, wasn't crazy. Her family wasn't crazy about the Parises, and the Putnam family wanted her land.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now a museum up in Danvers. It's a beautiful place. And after she was hung, nobody was burned here, by the way. They were just hung or pressed.
Mm-hmm.
Her sons came and buried her back on the farm, but in an unknown place, though. We don't know where she's buried.
Is part of what you're trying to say that the Gloucester witches were accused more for, as you say, the old grudges that were
yep.
held, whereas the Salem scene was more random and or
I don't know if it was more random.
Are you drawing a contrast between Gloucester and Salem?
Well, Salem was more unified into Congregationalism, and the Gloucester people didn't give a damn about what they said. They said a lot of, you know, things that other people, other families were angry about and tried to avenge later on.
Mm. So were the Gloucester women accused by Gloucester people or by out-of-town people?
Well, I think Eleanor Babson lent some... said something about the Rose, even though John Rowe back his descendants were accused, but they also lived right next door to the Babsons. Their place was next to the Babsons, and I think Eleanor might have thought something.
I like the way you talked about how difficult it was to impose authority or for people to acquire authority in Gloucester, and how various, and Conan also took it on the land at some point to go to Salem from Gloucester, but.
And what was his position?
What was he?
Was he a big shot?
Well, he ultimately found Salem, but he started out in Gloucester and he got PO'd for some reason. But all of that, I think what you were driving at is still, in strange ways, Gloucester is still a very factional town, and people try to acquire authority and force politically now in various ways. But what did you ever run across Griffin's letter?
No.
Well, that's my favorite because there was a company of shipbuilders, boat builders in Gloucester, and they were
when?
Around Blindman's time, because he finked on them. He accused them of violating the Sabbath by building a boat on the Sabbath. And so he was able to summon the militia commanded by an Endicott who came down and busted them for boat building and violating the Sabbath. And in the PS to that letter, they were congratulating themselves on successfully punishing Griffin's company. The PS said they were commending, Endicott was commending whoever ran, was the head of the militia for establishing his family's ventures in iron, which was the Saugus Ironworks. So basically, like you were pointing out about capitalism and the authority of that capitalism grew and individualism over the community. I think Gloucester was a very communal place in the sense that I think you're talking about, and they had their own peculiar ways of working and helping each other communally, like Griffin's company. And then somehow, and this is what I still think we're struggling with, when authority from the outside or even within starts pursuing a certain venture like iron and steel or leisure port or New Gloucester or Harbor
Town.
That's
what it's called, New Gloucester.
Harbor Town, yeah. I mean, how does this happen? And how do these things sort of happen in Gloucester? And how does political force get generated around here? We're still, I think, struggling with this, but within the, I think the authority to bust Griffin's company or to accuse somebody of a witch of witchcraft and punish them accordingly. I mean, that's what interests me: is how people acceded to that authority, how the authority was formed, and how people then, whether or not it was religious, as you said, how Gloucester was a little bit more tolerant of Quakers versus Boston. That's what I think is remarkable about Gloucester is that there was a little bit more tolerance. But again, how were people punished for not respecting authority, and where did the authority come from that they were supposed to respect? And Gloucester seems very ambiguous about that.
Much more anarchistic than the rest of the place. And as Emerson said, it's the perfect harbor, and so there's always New Gloucester people coming in to steal it away from the rest of us.
All these grudges within families and things. But why did certain families, like you said, Babson, prevail and have the force of the law behind them to do what they did, to accuse other people, and as that happened in Salem? How did it happen here?
They were rich.
Yeah. Exactly. Hi, honey.
One of the tenets of Calvinism was that wealth and prosperity were visible evidence of God's grace.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We still have that.
Yeah. Yep. And poverty makes you a no.
Yeah. We're outside of the pale.
Women who were rich were also outside of the pale. Women
well,
were
women
in control of their own, great. And then some grandmother was found guilty. She was a landowner.
And same with the nurse family.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rebecca Nurse.
So if you had your own voice, whether it was because you were taking care of yourself or not.
Can't get too uppity.
Well, the Council of Trent, which was like 300 or something, it was a huge debate, which the misogynists eventually won, as to whether women had souls. So that whole subhuman...
Yeah, it didn't start at the Inquisition.
No, it was Catholic doctrine. And, it was convenient for, people who wanted to... suppress women, accuse them of witchcraft and whatever. They were outside of
the... Who was Lilith?
Huh?
Who was Lilith?
She was Adam's first wife, according
to Jewish tradition.
Jewish tradition? I thought she was Egyptian.
She found it difficult to obey him, so she left.
According to who?
Me.
Yes, he's
me.
No, that's... It's
in the tradition. It's oral tradition stuff, I think. And then she became the bride of Asmodeus, a form of Satan, and produced all these children. And then she became associated in people's minds with wanting to kill children. And so one of the things you do if you are a superstitious woman, Jewish woman in the 18th, 19th century, you would all around the crib or all around your bed, if you were going to have a baby, you would have things that said, out Lilith, and you would have amulets and red thread and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So Eve was not the disobedient one, Lilith was. She was bad.
So Eve was really Lilith.
Well,
no.
It's, you know, you could see it that way if you wanted to. But that isn't the way most of the tradition is.
Although Judith Sargent Murray had a great take on Eve. Eve wasn't really total nebbish.
No,
she
wasn't.
Adam
was nebbish.
Yeah. Well, that was Judith Sargent Murray's thing, that it took all of the wiles of the serpent, as she writes, to convince Eve. I mean, like these supernatural wiles of the serpent to convince Eve to try the apple. And when she turned to Adam with the apple, she said, here, try this. And he said, okay.
Anything, honey.
So okay,
can
I'm
I
off
just
the
ask
hook
you
now.
One more question?
Yeah.
So, almost.
Nobody in Gloucester, except for Babson, accused these women. It was all from outside.
No. The
Gloucester
women were all accused by, they were all descendants of the first families who came here, and they were accused by other members of other first families over stuff that happened back in, 16.
Even scoring.
Yeah.
The Hatfields and the McCoys.
Right.
Yeah.
So did the Sephards ever stop? Did they ever get settled? Or did they go down generations?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you hear things like, mother was a tar box. That explains everything.
What does tar box mean?
That's a name. That's a great name. That's been around here for a while. Peter always used to say that. But yeah, certainly. Neighborhoods,
yeah.
Riverdale Mills against Bayview, against Lanesville,
There were these
godsons
who had to hide their mother up in Hollywood Point. The godhouse was supposed to have been a hiding place for the mother who was accused of witchcraft, because that was considered to be the farthest out that people knew, the frontier, they wouldn't be found there. So.
Yeah, I mean, back in the 1650s and 60s, you could accuse somebody of witchcraft and that they would sue you back. But once the 1690s happened, Paris let loose these girls, I don't blame the girls. You know what? I don't like the crucible because it makes everything the fault of these silly girls when it was really not that. I mean, it's another anti-feminist kind of a story, the crucible was.
There's a new history by Mary Beth Norton. Says these girls were, a lot of them were orphaned by
Indian Wars, and they were petrified.
They were traumatized.
And one of them lived in Paris's house. Yeah. Her parents were killed up in New York or someplace.
Yeah, horrible. And imagine living without streetlights. Really?
It was dark.
Yeah. Creepy at night.